Thanks for listening to Rare Bird Radio. I'm Doug Cooper, author of the award-winning fiction Outside In and The Investment Club and the 2019 thriller Focus Lost. This podcast is sponsored by Rare Bird Books in Los Angeles, a publisher of 50-plus books per year distributed worldwide by PGW. Today, I have the pleasure of being in conversation with widely published essayist, fiction and nonfiction storyteller, and documentary filmmaker Lauren Stevens. Her new novel, All Sorrows Can Be Born, is available wherever books are sold. Lauren's work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, MacGuffin, and many, many more. The book she co-wrote with Cliff Simon, Paris Nights, My Year at the Moulin Rouge, was deemed one of the best titles from an independent press by Kirkus Book Reviews. A two-time nominee of the Pushcart Prize, Lauren is president and founder of the ghostwriting companies Write Wisdom and Bright Star Memoirs. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you, Doug. I'm delighted to be here. And thank you to Tyson and Alexandra for putting this together this evening. And I'm really looking forward to chatting with you, Doug.
Absolutely. Really loved your book. And I think we'll just dive right into it because there's so many questions that I have for you. And, you know, first, just to kick it off, why did you choose to write this story? You know, what's the question that you wanted to answer?
The question that I was really searching to answer is, why would a mother give up her child? And in writing the novel, I think I discovered the answer, at least as best I could. I should mention that All Sorrows Can Be Born is based on my husband's family history. And a few of the characters are based on his birth parents and his adoptive parents. So I had the gift of having some of the people alive so that I could interview them in the same way that I interview my author clients when I'm ghostwriting a book. I don't know if I would have been able to write this story had they not been generous with their time and shared what they could. Obviously, memory is kind of a tricky thing, and there's always a sense of, you know, is this the truth or is this the way they saw something? But it was such a rich story. And I, being a mother myself of a son, I could not imagine giving up my child under any circumstances. So I really just had the barest inkling of what was behind my heroine Noriko's decision to give away her little three-year-old son, Hisashi, to relatives in the United States to put him on an airplane when he was a toddler all by himself and fly halfway around the world to be met with his new parents and then to grow up in the Badlands of Montana. How could that have happened? And as I say, I heard bits and pieces of this story from my husband. He's not a very introspective person the way I am as a writer, and I'm sure you are too. We're always in there to dig and dig and dig. And he's much more, takes things as they are. I want to know every little detail. And so I set out on this journey to discover why this would have happened, how this could have happened, what motivated my husband's mother to give up her one and only precious child.
Yeah, and it's very personal. I mean, you can feel it. I mean, I described it as just a long, comforting embrace that just very emotional to read, but one that you also don't want to let go. It's like when somebody gives you that hug and you can feel their sadness, and it's just, but you don't want to let go because there's just that connection. And you know, you're an accomplished writer and have written a lot of different things. So how was the process of writing this very personal story, but yet not about you, but about people you know and care about?
Well, the first thing that happened with this book is that my husband asked me to turn it into a novel and to change the names of the main characters, because he said to me, you know, some of the characters are no longer with us. For example, his father died at a very young age, shortly after he was, my husband was given away. So obviously I couldn't interview him. And then I had to create characters that would move the story along, some of which were purely my own imagination. And I was very nervous about it because I'm, in a sense, doing honor to his family. And I'm aware of some of the sensitivity of some of the subject matter that I had to, you know, touch upon and really push. And I was a little bit scared. And it's taken me a while to not see, you know, grenades lobbing over the the transom, as it were. The book came out in May, and so far I haven't gotten any hate mail. So I think I did okay. I was especially concerned about the town he grew up in, Glendive, Montana. You know, that I would not create a caricature situation, that I would really get in and understand the motivations of people. I mean, you have to understand that my husband's adoptive parents were also Japanese. One was native born and one was became a citizen of the United States. She was actually his aunt. And they lived probably close to 800 miles from the next nearest Japanese or Asian family. So they were a kind of a fish out of water, as it were. And yet they were accepted by the community. I will say that at times my husband, when he was a little boy, would be teased and called names, even through high school. Chairman Chow and Lai, Melonhead, you know, as kids are wont to do. And there's one conversation that I repeat in the book, which actually happened, where his adoptive mother finds out that one of the children in his school called him a dirty Jap. And his adoptive mother said, "What did you say?" And he said, "No, I'm not a dirty Jap. I'm a clean Jap." And, you know, there was the smile and there was a laugh. But behind that was, you know, also great pain. To know that your child I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, you talked a little bit about the painful decision that they make in giving away their child, and they, you open up with that scene in the book, and then you go back and you tell their stories. Why did you feel it was important to start with this as the kind of opening scene, inciting incident?
I really felt that that was such a powerful moment in the story and was kind of a fulcrum between what came before and that what comes afterwards, because we take you well into the, you know, the story begins in the early 1940s with the bombing of Hiroshima, which is where my husband's birth mother was born, and she lived through that devastation. And then the book ends in the 1980s. So we're talking about a 40-year swath of time that I need to take my reader through. And so this moment is kind of almost the midpoint of the story. And frankly, I felt that it was a powerful hook to engage my reader who would, I hope, then say, how could this have happened? What led up to this? And then the story carries itself forward to the resolution, which I won't give away, other than to say there is a reunion between his mother and him at the end of the book. How that plays out, I'll let the reader see for themselves. But that was probably the most difficult scene that I had to write. And in fact, through several drafts, I avoided it completely. I just thought, I can't do this. I can't write this scene. It's too hard. But then I thought I was cheating myself and I was cheating the reader, for them not to see the grown-up Hisashi and the 40-something-year-old Noriko meeting at the end of the book and embracing one another and feeling that mother-son bond that was, as he said, visceral. It wasn't even anything he could articulate. It was just something that he felt in his wild heart.
Yeah, and I, you know, as a reader, I expected that. You know, I think I would have felt cheated if I didn't have that payoff. So I don't think it's any kind of spoilers here, because you really, it's one of the things that you're driving as a reader. You're like, okay, you're expecting this payoff. Like you said, you don't know how it's going to happen, what the situation, what the outcome is going to be. But you feel that from the beginning.
You know, and I'm so glad you feel that way. It validates my instincts. And the fact that it was Hisashi who engineered the reunion. I mean, all those years between, there was virtually no connection between the two of them other than birthday cards. And Noriko would light a candle at each birthday that would pass. And or maybe send a present, but they never ever saw one another. And he had this burning need to meet her, which I looked at a lot of stories of adoptees who want to know who their birth parents are, their birth mother, their birth father, both of them. Of course, he knew that his father was dead. So, you know, he didn't have that opportunity, but he had a drive to meet her and to go to Japan and to see, in a sense, what his life might have been like had he grown up in his country of origin rather than in the Badlands of Montana.
Yeah, and you, like I said, you start out with this, so the reader knows from the beginning that this is kind of the defining moment when they make that hard decision.
Yes.
And you're thinking, how can Pim do this? But as you start telling the story of Ichiro and Noriko, and there's many times where Noriko even questions, and she outwardly says when Ichiro's telling the story that she doesn't understand, you know, how it can be. And I just had this one passage I wanted to share where Ichiro's telling Noriko about his father sending him and his sister Mitsuko away. And Noriko says, I can't imagine a father being so cruel and heartless as to abandon his children. And, you know, there's other instances, you know, so what changed in her that she eventually made that same decision?
Well, I'm glad you picked up the sort of breadcrumbs, you know, of foreshadowing, because that's a technique as a writer that I love. And I think you do that very well in your book, Focus Lost, where you're sort of tipping your hand a little bit to the reader. Her husband, Ichiro, whom she marries, and practically right on their honeymoon, she becomes pregnant with her baby, and he almost simultaneously, her husband is diagnosed with tuberculosis, which is at that time was almost a death sentence You know, there were some antibiotics that were available, some treatments that the Americans had brought into Japan after the war. But he was sent away to a sanitarium. And for long periods of time, Noriko was left to raise her little boy alone. And this also did horrible things to Ichiro's sense of himself and engendered a huge amount of pain and shame. And she finally felt, because of what he said to her, that if she gave away her child to his sister, that somehow that would save her husband's life. So she made this choice. It's almost like Sophie's choice, you know, which child to give away, the boy or the girl. In this case, it's, what do I do? Do I keep my son and risk the fact that, you know, my husband is going to go down into an even deeper spiral of illness and depression? One of the things I learned about tuberculosis, and again, you know, there's so much research involved with doing this book, is that one of the side effects of TB and the medications is it can have terrible mental side effects to the patient and cause them to hallucinate. And, you know, when you've read the book, Ichiro hallucinates and sometimes thinks he sees people that aren't there, or they are there and he doesn't see them. And those were some of the most fun scenes for me to write. I have this whole Stephen King part of myself. And so I got to sort of play it out when I was writing some of those phantasmagorical scenes, as it were. And I had to sort of hold myself back. But, you know, she saw him devolving into a pit of despair. And she thought, you know, maybe this will save my husband's life. And he kept on saying to her, we'll have more children. You know, even though she thought, is he crazy? We can't even support the child we have. But she made this choice. I mean, at one point, her sister was going to offer to take the little boy. And she said, no, I can't do that, because Ichiro will see my child growing up in someone else's hands right underneath my nose. This is, this would be unconscionable. So she figures, you know, sending him 2,000-3,000 miles away is going to lift the monkey off his back, as it were. And of course, as you say, she later on, she questions her decision, and her own mother says, are you crazy? You know, that you're going to be doing this? This child is my grandson. You know, you just can't do it. And, you know, she hangs up the telephone because she's crying too much to even be able to go on with the conversation. Yeah.
And you research that you did for tuberculosis.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
The time in pain for. I was saying that you talked a little bit about your research.
Yes.
that you did for tuberculosis. And I've spent a little bit of time in Japan for work years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I loved and just had so much respect for your writing is how you really captured the setting and the culture and the people of Japan. And you know, you said you have a family, your husband and the family members, but have you spent time there? Did you go there to do your research? Because you're so descriptive on locations, and you know, you really mix in a lot of the beautiful Japanese language, and just really remarkable how you were able to capture that.
Well, thank you. I was there for 10 days. I went with my husband's adoptive mother, who was born in Osaka. I invited her to go with me because my husband's birth mother speaks no English. So I needed an interpreter. And I had the sense that if I just hired someone there, that it would be very awkward because we were going to be talking about incredibly sensitive matters that she might not have wanted to tell anyone else. But because it was Mitsuko, she felt comfortable. So Mitsuko and I went to Japan and we stayed there for 10 days. And every day we would have what we called book time, where I would interview Noriko, whose real name is Miyoko. We would do that for about 2 hours. And it would kind of go around and around. It was Japanese to English to Japanese to English. And, you know, try doing that for 2 hours.
I can imagine.
It's a prescription for a headache, I'll tell you that. And then the rest of the time each day, you know, we have some fun thing planned. We went to Arashiyama. We went to Kyoto. I took everyone to see a Bunraku theater presentation. I was at one time a theater producer, and one of the shows I produced was the puppet theater of Bruce Schwartz, who was a world-renowned puppeteer who studied in Japan for many years and perfected the Bunraku puppetry art form. And so we spent 6 hours in the theater watching this ancient art form. And, you know, the food, I mean, we had family gatherings, and we would go to a private room in a restaurant and have a wonderful meal, or we had the 7-course meal in Arashiyama. And, you know, it was an incredible experience, because I was treated not like an outsider because of my family. And when I got to the hotel, when we took the flight from LA to, let's see, how did we go? I think we flew direct, or maybe through San Francisco to Osaka, and got to our hotel. And I made a reservation at the fanciest hotel in Osaka as a treat to my mother-in-law, because she was doing me this unbelievable service. There were 20 relatives in the lobby waiting for us with these huge bouquets of orchids, which really lasted for the whole 10 days that we were there. And I was just embraced. And then there were some incredibly poignant moments where we went to my husband's father's grave, and his sister Mitsuko, who is his adoptive mother, had not been back to Japan in 50 years. And seeing her brother's grave was just, you know, really overwhelming. Because she left Japan before he died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I think knowing how much the Japanese you know, of them live together and live with family, I think that's what made it even more of a remarkable decision, you know, in giving up that child. And you know, so much of Japanese culture is, you know, very, very there's a duality to it, right? What you show on the outside compared to what you feel on the inside. And when you were doing the research, did you feel at times like you were running up tough to crack through, you know, kind of get behind that facade?
You know, I think that my husband's mother in particular was so anxious to unburden herself of this story. Many of the details that she had never shared with anyone before, she didn't hide anything really. I felt that she was telling the truth. And the title of the book comes from Isaac Dinesen or Hannah Arendt. We're not really sure. It's in a conversation between the two of them, and the epigraph is, all sorrows can be borne if you can tell the story. Okay. And so, you know, it was manifested through my mother-in-law being able to really tell the story and reveal certain parts of what happened. And I won't give them away because it would be a total spoiler. But in being able to share some of the things that she went through, it made her feel better. Yeah.
And
so
did you
she did not hide?
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, some of the family and the dinners that you were able to go to, and yeah. Japanese dinners are when all that's when you really learn and you really experience. I mean, they just really open up and have fun. And you had probably had some remarkable and fantastic dinners over there.
Well, there's nothing better than Japanese food.
Yeah.
But I will say that the wedding scene that I wrote wasn't so happy.
Oh, really?
You know, when Ichiro and Noriko marry, you know, her father is not so happy.
And right.
He lets everyone know that he's not happy about this marriage, that he doesn't think that Ichiro is worthy of his beautiful daughter. So that wedding scene was not, you know, a typical happy family gathering, which happened.
Yeah, and he had invested a lot in her, you know, in her dreams of wanting, you know, to be an actress, performer, and she didn't make it. You know,
right.
She has those big dreams and there's quite. So I think that, again, public kind of disappointment that he faced, and he didn't want to go through that again. So, you know, I think his in the end, it was intense love and caring that he had for her, but unfortunately it manifested in that way. But, you know, talking about her big dreams, and they're squashed pretty quickly in the book, or at least the first, you know, her initial dreams, and she meets a famous movie director in the tea room where she's working, and he comments that the only difference between her and his leading lady was willing to risk rejection.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think Noriko gave up so easily just from the one failed audition?
You know, I think in that particular scene where the movie director offers her a walk-on part, you know, because he spots her in the tea room and she's so beautiful and vivacious, and she's afraid that Ichiro will be jealous. And she's also, it's like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. She knows that Ichiro loves her and that he wants to marry her. Is she going to give up that surety on the off chance that maybe, you know, maybe she'll be discovered, maybe she'll become a star? I think she just felt it wasn't worth the gamble. The earlier scene where she tries out for the Takarazuka Theater Academy, which is a, you know, famous school that produces all women theater troupes, and women play men's roles, and it's incredibly popular. I don't know if you've ever been to the Takarazuka, but it's pretty amazing. She's almost 18, and you cannot audition past 18. So when she is denied entry on the first go round, there's no second chance for her. That's it. It's over. So it was a question of, really, in that case, a question of timing. And of course, she was completely devastated, because when she was in high school, she was the star of every single play. And as you mentioned, her father supported her in all of her dreams and paid for drama lessons and singing lessons and dance lessons. And, you know, he was heavily invested in it. And then when she fails, he's embarrassed, you know, and he basically says, you know, you failed me. which there could be nothing worse between a daughter and a father than to feel that you have failed your parent. So I don't know if I fully answered your question, but the funny thing is that my mother was an opera singer and she had a chance to really go into the big time. And she auditioned, and one person who heard her said, "You can make it." And the other person said, "You're never going to make it." And she listened to the person who said that she would never make it because she just didn't have that confidence, you know. And and as a theater producer myself, and as a former film producer, you know, I see it's not only talent that makes for a successful actor or actress or playwright or whatever, but it's just that perseverance and, you know, the mantra of saying every no is one step closer to a yes.